Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ravi Agrawal, Foreign Policy's Editor-in-Chief. This is FP Live. Welcome to the show. So last weekend, in back-to-back votes in Congress, the House finally approved $95 billion in foreign aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. As it happened, a majority of Republicans voted against aid to Ukraine, but it wasn't enough to prevent the first major tranche of assistance to Kyiv since 2022, when the Republican Party won back control of the House. It is clear for all to see that the GOP is divided on Ukraine. But if you were to leave that one issue aside for just a minute, is there a broader Republican foreign policy today? And if Donald Trump wins the presidency this November, a thought that we really must contend with, which advisors will have his ear on foreign policy issues? My guest today has spent a lot of time thinking about the GOP's foreign policy. Matthew Kronig is the co-author of a new book, We Win, They Lose, Republican Foreign Policy and the New Cold War. In that book, he and Dan Negrea make the case that outside of Ukraine, there is actually a lot of unity within the Republican Party on foreign policy. They're trying to lay claim to interpreting the foreign policy legacy of Trump 1.0 and to propose what a 2.0 policy should look like. Where they've landed, broadly, is what they're calling a Trump-Reagan fusion. Now, Ronald Reagan was very different from Donald Trump, but the point they're making is that both based their policies on a belief in peace through strength. As you'll see in this conversation, I don't really agree that Trump's policies follow some grand worldview or that it unites the Republican perspective at large, but this discussion isn't about me. I wanted to hear his perspective and air it out, and I wanted all of you to hear it too, because it's a point of view we're going to get a lot more of in the coming months. Mike Pompeo, a former CIA director and Secretary of State under Trump, wrote the preface to this book, We Win, They Lose. There is clearly a movement within the GOP to present Trump 2.0 as a Trump-Reagan fusion. Matt Kronig explains all of this nicely. He served in the Department of Defense and the intelligence community during the Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations. Today, he's the Vice President and Senior Director of the Atlantic Council's Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. Perhaps most importantly, though, for an FP audience, he's a columnist at our magazine and co-writes the feature It's Debatable, where he pits his views against those of Emma Ashford. Remember, if you like this podcast, you can also try us on video, live, on foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to ask questions too. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount. Okay, let's dive in. Matt Kronig, welcome back to FP Live.
Ravi, thank you very much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Oh, the pleasure is ours. So let me just start with this. To most observers, as I said, when it comes to foreign policy, the Republican Party seems to be in disarray. You say otherwise. So what exactly is a Republican foreign policy right now?
Yes, well, there's a lot of focus on the divisions within the party because of the divisions over Ukraine that you pointed out. But as my co-author and I argue in this book, we think that there is a lot of unity actually in the party when you take a step back. And we call this new kind of synthesis, the Trump-Reagan fusion that takes some of the traditional principles of Reaganism and updates them for the 21st century with some of Trump's ideas. And essentially we argue that it starts in political philosophy, that conservatives and progressives have different views about the nature of the international system and the proper role of the US government. And both Reaganites and Trumpians are conservative, different from progressives. In defense policy, we argue that both Reaganites and Trumpians believe in peace through strength. The idea that the U.S. government should be so strong that adversaries don't challenge us, but that the purpose is peace, and they're skeptical of kind of military interventions. In economic policy, we'd say it's free and fair trade, that actually Reagan and Trump were more alike when it comes to economic policy than many people may realize. And then in terms of values, they believe in American exceptionalism, which is different, I think, from how the left views the United States. And then if you go through every major issue, they agree that China is the greatest threat facing the country, that NATO allies need to do more to defend Europe, that the Iran nuclear deal was a mistake and we need to be tougher against Iran. The climate threat is exaggerated. Border security is a problem. So again, looking more broadly, I think there is a lot of unity in Republican foreign policy today.
So I want to take on some of those issues individually and just challenge a little bit of that sort of symphony you're describing between these two. But overall, what critics of this sort of Reagan-Trump fusion view might say is that isn't all of this really just a search to somehow explain Trumpism, to try to frame into logic what often seems to most people unpredictable and chaotic, and to try and turn into a party policy something that is often just about one man and what tends to benefit him?
Well, I think that is part of the reason that we wanted to write this book, is what is Trumpism and what are the through lines in the foreign policy? Because I think you have other people who are also trying to do that, but doing it in a mistaken way, in my views, because I think you do have some isolationists who are saying that Trumpism is essentially isolationism. He's protectionist. And I think that's not the case. If you actually look at how he governed in his first term, you can criticize the way he did that, but I don't think it's fair to say it was isolationist. The United States remained engaged in varying ways in major theaters like Europe, the Middle East, and the Indo-Pacific. And so I think some are trying to redefine Trumpism in a certain direction. And my co-author and I wanted to try to capture what we think really was the through line in Trumpism. And then to point out that in some ways it's more consistent with Reaganism and some of the traditions in the Republican Party than many people may appreciate. And in some ways, maybe a return to some of the party's traditions that George W. Bush and other Republicans may have strayed from in the early part of this century.
Mm. So I want to come to the Reagan-Trump similarities in a minute, but just on the isolationist point, Trump has often sort of suggested strongly that, you know, he could pull out of NATO. And then more importantly, during his term, he did pull out of the Paris Climate Accords. He did pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. He did pull out of the Iran nuclear deal against the wishes of every other UN Security Council member. And when you add all of that up, then America First begins to sound a little bit like America Alone. And then Trump is at the vanguard of a movement that genuinely seems to believe that America should stay out of world affairs. I mean, isn't all of that... isn't it fair to interpret a lot of that as isolationism?
I don't think so. And there was a lot there, so let me take it in pieces. So first, several of those agreements you mentioned, I think that conservatives in the United States, Republicans in the United States, thought that they were bad deals and didn't advance American interest. Remember, there was bipartisan opposition to the Iran nuclear deal. Every Republican in Congress and some Democrats opposed it. Every single Republican candidate in 2016 was opposed to the deal and said they were going to rip it up. Trump was the relative moderate of that group who said he wanted to try to renegotiate it, and he did try to renegotiate it for the first year. But Marco Rubio and others said they were going to rip it up on day one. Paris Climate Accord, same thing. I think Republicans thought it was a bad deal. I think a Jeb Bush or another Republican president would have also withdrawn from the deal. And then if you look at alliances, you know, I think often people think of alliances only in terms of the European alliances. But if you look in the Middle East, the Trump administration brought about the Abraham Accords, strengthening America's partnerships in the region, expanded on the Quad initiative that had started before. So I think strengthening partnerships and alliances in the Indo-Pacific. And then even if you look at Europe, the rhetoric was often tough against the European allies. But the actual actions, the Trump administration increased spending for NATO, brought in two new members to the alliance during the Trump administration, killed a bunch of Russian mercenaries on the ground in Syria, provided lethal aid to the Ukrainians for the first time. The Obama administration, remember, would only provide non-lethal aid, strengthened the U.S. presence in Poland. So I think that if you actually look at the outcome of the policy, the Trump administration did strengthen U.S. alliances in key regions.
Mm. And we'll come to the difference between rhetoric and outcomes in a little bit later in this discussion. But I wanted to sort of hone in on the bit that you agree is the biggest sort of arena of disagreement within the GOP's foreign policy, and that is Ukraine. And the last weekend kind of was more evidence of that. And it seems to me that part of the reason we even got here with Saturday's vote in the House was that Trump eventually didn't really stand in the way of that going through. Is that right?
I think that's right. And, people say that Trump is opposed to Ukraine or that he would sell Ukraine out to Russia. But if you actually look at what he said, he hasn't said that. He said he is in favor of supporting Ukraine so long as it's a loan. What he said about his Ukraine strategy, he said that if he's elected, he would go to Zelensky and say that you need to negotiate. Trump has said he wants to stop the killing. But what all people often forget is he also said, and I'll go to Putin and say, you need to negotiate or I'll give Zelensky more than he's ever got. And so I think there is the possibility that actually Trump administration could provide more aid and longer range weapons and things to Ukraine than the Biden administration if Putin doesn't go along with that.
But then it seems like ATACMS, for example, have become part of this new sort of push to give aid to Ukraine.
Yes, and that's one of the interesting things about this bill that went through the House is in many ways it's more forward-leaning than the Biden administration's strategy. So this new package requires the Biden administration to articulate a clear strategy, including metrics, which has been one of the complaints from conservatives that Biden's fighting as long as it takes, but as long as it takes to do what. Second, it would provide the longer range ATACMS that would give Ukraine the ability to hold at risk targets further in Crimea, like the Kerch Bridge, but also in potentially in Russia. And then also this package strengthens the sanctions against Russia by eliminating waivers and strengthens secondary sanctions for countries that are violating the energy sanctions. In many ways, this bill would strengthen, force the Biden administration to strengthen its approach toward Ukraine and against Russia.
Mm. So let me dig into a little bit more of the Trump-Reagan fusion that you and your co-author Dana Gray are trying to propose in your book, which could be sort of a normative vision for what a future GOP foreign policy could look like. And I guess one of the immediate criticisms of a Trump-Reagan fusion is that there is more that differentiates them than unites them. So, for example, Reagan would never say the things Trump has said about NATO, for example, thereby, leaving European leaders feeling very insecure. It may have, in terms of outcomes, played a role in Europeans investing more in defense, but, a classic Reaganite would argue that is not the way to do it. And then there's trade, for example. Reagan only occasionally relied on tariffs. Trump, however, has gone way, way further on that across the board and has threatened the kinds of tariffs that would make it much harder for, any traditional Reaganite to say that this is a free market administration.
So a couple of points on that. One, you're absolutely right that Trump and Reagan are also different. And I think many people have also pointed that out in terms of style and in terms of character. And so that's all true. I think what we're trying to point out in the book is that when it comes to policies, they are more similar than many people may appreciate. And let's take trade as an example. So people think of Reagan as a free trader, Trump as a protectionist. But if you go back to Reagan, as you pointed out, he did use tariffs against Japan, against the European common market. against other U.S. friends and allies. And he said the point of this was to bring about free and fair trade. And he did was able to persuade Japan to curtail some of its market distorting practices through those tariffs. And similarly for Trump, he's not protectionist for its own sake. He's been pretty clear that the purpose is to bring about fair and reciprocal trade, did update trade agreements with Mexico and Canada and with Korea, tried to get a trade agreement with China. And so, you know, you talk about the scale of the tariffs threatened, and Trump has threatened, if he's reelected, to put in place, and I forget the latest number, maybe you're tracking a 10% across the board tariff or something like that. But I think we also have to remember Trump's negotiating style. I don't think that's his kind of final statement of policy. I think that's an opening negotiating position. And then if countries don't want that 10% tariff, then I think that's the invitation to a discussion to get to a trade agreement that would be fair and reciprocal in his view.
So, Matt, speaking of maximalist opening positions in any negotiation, I was struck by the title of your book. So the title is We Win, They Lose, which strikes me as zero sum. And this, of course, was Reagan's famous line about his goal from competition with the Soviet Union, that the United States would win, the Soviet Union would lose. I'm curious how that works today. So China is a far bigger economy, and crucially, it is far more integrated into every country's economy. If you look at the world, most countries count China as among its top few trading partners. So assuming that, you know, the broad kind of agreement in the GOP and frankly at a bipartisan level, even among Democrats, that China is the major sort of threat to American leadership around the world. If you agree on that, and then you take the title of your book, that America wins, China loses should be the normative approach. But if China loses, the world loses, no?
No. So let me explain why. And so you're right, the quote, the title of the book comes from the Reagan quote. He was asked about his foreign policy for the Soviet Union, and he said, well, it's simple. Some might say it's simplistic, but it's this: we win, they lose. And it was kind of shocking at the time. It was in a period of detente where others were trying to kind of manage the competition with the Soviet Union. Reagan saw it differently. He thought that coexistence with the Soviet Union created a kind of unacceptable moral equivalence between the free world and the Soviet Union and its captive nations. But he also thought that the free world and the United States had inherent strengths. The Soviet Union had fundamental flaws, and if we took the gloves off and forced them to compete, that he could end the Cold War, and turned out he was right. So what is the goal for the current competition with China? And this has been something of a hobby of mine over the past couple of years, to ask senior U.S. officials, what are we trying to achieve? You know, competition is not a strategy. And I haven't really gotten a clear answer. Some have said, well, it's to avoid war. I think that's not right. Some said, well, we're just going to have to do this forever. I think that's not quite right. Carthage and Rome still aren't competing. This is going to come to an end one way or another. And so we think the answer is we win, they lose. Which essentially we define as getting to a place where China no longer has the ability or the will to threaten America's vital interests. So it doesn't mean China as a country has to lose. It just means that the current aggressive strategy of Xi Jinping has to lose, that we need to get to a place where China no longer has the will or the ability to threaten U.S. vital interests. So I could keep going, but maybe I'll stop
yeah.
there.
Well, just to layer on that, Matt. So, you know, I appreciate the nuance in describing what victory is and what losing is. But if losing means that China can't act from a position of strength, that would mean, you know, severe economic decline at the very least. And I guess the point I was trying to put forward was, if you speak to the vast majority of countries in Asia, in Africa, they all have problems with China, for sure, but they don't necessarily want to see China lose, even in the way that you're describing. They need a vibrant China. They need a growing China to help their own economies.
Yeah. So a couple things I'd say to that. One, you know, I think the country that's done the most to constrain China so far is China, and Xi Jinping's economic policies over the past several years and his aggressive foreign policy have undercut China's successful growth model. So the biggest cause of China's recent decline has been Xi Jinping. But then second, what we advocate for in the book for the United States, but also for allies and partners and countries in the global South, is a de-risking. And so it's not to say that you need to cut off trade with China altogether, but in sensitive national security areas, and even for countries in the global South, it's not in their interest to have China control a digital infrastructure of the 21st century, not in their interest to allow China to put in place infrastructure that could be used for military or intelligence purposes. But that if they want to continue to export soybeans to China, if they want to buy cheap made in China t-shirts, that would be fine. And so I think this kind of selective de-risking approach, both for the United States and others, is a way for them to maintain economic engagement with China, but also to protect themselves from the threats that that China poses.
Let me take on a couple of other topics. So in an excerpt of your book that you ran in Foreign Policy, you describe the conservative viewpoint as one that sees the duty of the government to, quote, secure American interests in a dangerous world. And by contrast, you say, quote, that progressives tend to prioritize cooperation with other nations to address shared global challenges. Isn't the last few years of geopolitics basically showing that the main thing Washington has going for it is alliances, and that the main thing it tends to be vilified for is its desire to secure its interests come what may?
Well, this was one of the most interesting parts of the book for me to research and write because, you know, we're writing a book about Republican foreign policies. And in fact, we talked to an editor early on about this project. And this editor said, I don't really see any value in this. Is there really even a difference between a conservative and a Democratic foreign policy? Isn't it kind of the same? Biden's just pursuing the Trump approach. And so it forced us to think kind of from first principles. What does it mean to be a conservative? What does it mean to be a progressive? What is the worldview? How does that shape differences in foreign policy? And so we do start from these first principles and build up. And I do think that that's, and of course there is a broad middle, but I think that is the essentially the difference that conservatives think the world is dangerous, that the job of the U.S. government or any government is to look after its own people. And progressives, more informed by the European Enlightenment, the idea that past conflict and problems were the result of kind of ignorance, and that if we cooperate and apply science and reason, we can make the world a better place. So I do think that those are differences that inform big debates we've had over international institutions, use of force, and many other things. But, you know, the conservative worldview isn't that cooperating with other nations doesn't make sense. It's just that it's not a goal in and of itself, that sometimes cooperating with other nations can help the United States to secure its interest. And so alliances and partnerships are a great example of that. And so I don't think that so conservatives do value alliances for that purpose. And I think what we advocate for in the book is kind of an enlightened self-interest, that often what's good for the world, or what's good for the United States, a democratic superpower, is also good for the rest of the free world, and certainly would be better than if China or Russia were to dominate the international system.
I guess, you know, Matt, since we're discussing the differences between conservative thinking and progressive thinking in terms of U.S. foreign policy, the main arenas where I think this tends to clash the most, especially in terms of how progressives see big global problems as needing global cooperation in its very sort of through line of how to go forward with it, is if you examine the big crises that we tend to face, whether it is a pandemic or you know, a new global health disaster that is going to need to center cooperation, or climate change, which of course progressives do see as an existential threat and conservatives tend to want to downplay. But if you see it as an existential threat, or it ends up becoming more of an existential threat in a way that conservatives see more and more, then doesn't that challenge some of the principles of not kind of centering cooperation first?
Yeah, so we do address climate change with a chapter in the book. And I think what conservatives would say is that, yes, if you do want to bring down greenhouse gas emissions, if you do want to have an effective global response to things like pandemic, then that will require global cooperation. But I think where they disagree with progressives is they say, okay, we have to be realistic. Who are the partners we're talking about cooperating with here? And the answer is China and the Chinese Communist Party. If we want to solve climate change, they're the biggest greenhouse gas emitter. They're promising to increase their greenhouse gas emissions over the coming years, while the United States and Europe are already cutting their emissions. If you think about pandemics, of course, the big recent pandemic, COVID-19, started in China. And in both of these places, China is essentially a bad actor. If it had reported the pandemic earlier, we maybe could have prevented COVID-19 from becoming a pandemic. Still to this day, they refuse to allow the WHO to have an effective investigation. And then again, on climate change, they continue to increase their emissions. And so essentially saying we're going to cooperate with the Chinese Communist Party to solve these shared challenges is like saying we're going to cooperate with arsonists to stop fires. Yes, we're going to have to cooperate with them because they're the biggest source of the problem. But doing that's not going to be easy and may not even be possible at all.
So, I mean, obviously, I have to disagree with you there, Matt, but my disagreement is not the point of this conversation. But, you know, many people in the Global South will say that they didn't cause the sort of buildup of carbon emissions that the world is confronted with today, and they don't have the means in every case to deal with them, so on and so forth. This is a familiar debate, but that's where it comes from and why cooperation and leading with cooperation tends to be so important in any global conversation. But let me pivot a little bit, because a lot of our conversation so far has been about party elites. And I just want to talk about voters for a minute. So there was a recent Chicago Council of Global Affairs study, which showed that there was a growing divide between so-called Trump Republicans. These are people who have very favorable views of the former president, and so-called non-Trump Republicans. And that this has led to an overall shift in the party. So, for example, GOP supporters have usually been much more likely than Democrats to favor an active role abroad. And that's changed recently. So for the first time in this Chicago Council survey, a majority of Republicans said that it would be best for the future of the United States to stay out of world affairs. Now, you can define this as isolationism, but it is a Trumpian shift. How is that affecting the broader party?
Yes. Well, I'm not familiar with that specific poll, so I'd have to dig into it to respond to that in detail. But I think one thing American political scientists do know about American public opinion on foreign policy is, and oversimplifying a little bit, but essentially that the public doesn't really have an opinion on foreign policy. They, you know, they're busy going to work and raising their kids, and they're not experts on foreign policy, and they know it. So they tend to reflect the views of elites. And so I think if you go back and ask Republicans before the Trump era, their views on Russia, very negative toward Russia. But then with Trump as essentially the leader of the party, then obviously what he says does tend to show up in the views of the public. And so during the Trump years, you saw that among Republicans, negative views toward Russia declined. Negative views toward NATO increased. And so I do think that with the difference, and again, I think Russia-Ukraine may be an area of exception as we talk, where there is more disagreement with the party, then I think you're seeing that disagreement reflected within the public writ large.
And you are listening to Foreign Policy Live. Remember, you can watch these conversations live and on video on our website, foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to send us questions in advance, in addition to a range of other benefits, including our magazine. Sign up, use the code FPLIVE for a discount. That is FPLIVE, one word.
Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public sector future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
So I want to draw a line now between the discussion we've had so far and what I want to talk about in the next 15 minutes or so. You know, the point of bringing you on today, Matt, wasn't to debate you, but really to try and understand what a Trump foreign policy might look like, especially if he returns to power. And so as someone who studies this, Matt, and I should note, you might disagree with a lot of what Trump has to say about the world and a lot of his underpinning vision. What would a Trump 2.0 foreign policy look like?
Well, I think the place to start would be to look at how the first Trump administration went. And so I think my assessment of the first administration is that there was a lot of chaos in terms of the tweets and the conflicting messaging. But then if you look at the underlying policy and the results, I thought that it was pretty good and pretty consistent with how internationalist conservatives have managed international affairs in the past. And then again, looking at the results, peace in Europe, peace in the Middle East, the global economy was doing well, different from where we are now, of course, with a major war in Europe and a major war in the Middle East. So I guess I would expect a similar thing from a Trump 2 administration, probably a lot of chaos, a lot of tweets, confusing statements, maybe firing people, hiring and firing people by tweet. But I think the underlying principles, as we argue in the book, are still there, and that that despite the chaos, the policy would be pretty stable and lead to good outcomes. That would be my expectation and my hope.
So there's a school of thought that goes that in Trump's first term, the party wasn't quite ready to abandon internationalism in the way that he sometimes talked about. It opposed him, not just on that, but on many other things, on NATO. There's a worry that that would never happen in a second term because he will only pick people who will agree with him. He will have taken over the entire party. He will have installed loyalists in key positions. He will have gutted out certain departments, and that leaves fewer checks and balances. And so some of what you're describing about this difference between rhetoric and policy may then be eroded. And then what we might see is the policy just becomes the rhetoric and therefore more chaotic and more crazy seeming.
I get three quick points I'd make to that. One, people who served in the first Trump administration said that nobody forced Trump to do something he didn't want to do. You know, Mattis or H.R. McMaster. Yes, they were in the room, but they weren't the decision makers, and that Trump is a pretty stubborn person. And at the end of the day, the decisions were his, not Mattis's or others. Second thing I'd say is, and I think we learned this in the first Trump term and forgot it over the past few years, there was the famous statement that we should take Trump seriously, but not literally. Or that the people who like Trump take him seriously and not literally, the people who don't take him literally, but seriously. And so I think a lot of the controversies and the tweets are people taking him literally, like the statement recently that Russia can do whatever the hell it wants. You know, I don't think that will be the Trump administration's policy. That's the, you know, the literal phrase. And so, yeah, I think if you're taking him literally, then there's more chaos. But if you're taking him seriously, and I think the point there was the NATO allies do need to do more for their own defense. And I think there is agreement on that among Republicans, and that will be a focus of a second Trump term. So seriously, not literally, is point two. And then point three, I do think that there are good people who would want to serve in a second Trump term, including some of the people who served in the first term. So Mike Pompeo has said he'd be honored to serve again. Robert O'Brien is speculated as being somebody who would want to go into a Trump 2 administration, Senator Hagerty. So I do think that, like in the first term, Trump will have experienced people in cabinet posts giving him advice.
And of course, Mike Pompeo, former Secretary of State, former director of the CIA, has endorsed your book and written a foreword to it. So very much seems like there's a wider group of people who share your thinking of what a future Trump Republican foreign policy could look like. Let me flip some of this, Matt. What worries you about Trump 2.0?
Well, they are going to have to come into a dangerous world, ongoing, if they win, an ongoing war in Europe, an ongoing war in the Middle East, China threatening to invade Taiwan. And so in many ways, I think this is the most dangerous international security environment the United States and its allies have had to deal with since the end of the Cold War, but maybe since the most dangerous times of the Cold War. So I think whether for a Trump 2 or a Biden 2, a lot of challenges to deal with, a lot of things that can go wrong. The second thing, I guess I'd, I guess if it were up to me, I do have a different rhetorical style than Trump. I think getting the NATO allies to do more makes sense. If it were me in charge, I'd probably go about it in a different way. And so I do think that sometimes the communication style does worry allies. Does worry people within the United States. And so I think there would be a lot of confusion. Wait, was this tweet really the policy, or was this just a tweet? So I think that's another thing that concerns me. But overall, as I argue in the book, I do think that the policies that a Trump 2 would follow would be pretty good. So I guess this maybe gets to another worry is how does the rest of the world react to a Trump 2 administration? Because I think that does matter. And I think we did see some allies in the first Trump administration who thought, okay, this is where we are. We're going to work pragmatically with this team, and others who are maybe more hostile. And so I think that's a key variable as well. Does the rest of the world say, okay, this is the will of the American people. Let's have a constructive relationship with this new team. Or are they resisting in ways that are maybe counterproductive?
Mm. And do you not worry at all about sort of within the broader kind of right-wing ecosystem, this fascination / sympathy for, you know, leaders like Putin or Orban in Hungary? Doesn't that speak to something that is a worrying trend within the GOP and people aligned with it?
I guess personally, I don't really see that as much. And I think that a lot of people are making a lot about that. But again, if you look at the first term, a pretty tough policy on Putin, tougher than the Obama administration, tougher than I think the Biden administration. If you look at some of Trump's recent statements, he said something like he'll park a nuclear submarine outside of Russia, again, that he'd give Zelensky more than he's ever got. And I do think, though, that one of America's greatest strengths is its values. And we argue in the book that this is an ideological competition, that if this is just two great powers or great powers duking it out, then what's the incentive for America's democratic allies to side with us over China? But if we do make the case, no, this is about our values and our shared values. And, do you want to live in a world like we have for the past 70 years, governed by democratic principles and values, or one dominated by hostile authoritarian countries, then that's an easy decision for allies and partners to make. So I do think that our values are an important part of this. I'm not sure that that's exactly how Trump sees it. I think he is more of a kind of realist. But if you look at the people who served in the first Trump term, Pompeo, Nikki Haley, and the people who would likely serve in a second Trump term, I do think that broadly this is something that the Republican Party understands, that again, this American exceptionalism idea that American values are superior to the values of China and Russia.
Mm. Let me take a couple of subscriber questions, and then I do want to end with some of the people that a Trump 2.0 White House might consider in top foreign policy roles. Here's a question from Jared Kay, who asks, is there any advantage to having a quote-unquote erratic foreign policy? In other words, the inability for other countries to predict U.S. strategy, or does a lack of trust among allies outweigh the positives?
Yes. Well, I think he identified the cost and the benefits. So I think the cost, as we discussed earlier, is that there is worry among allies and among the American people of it's just so unpredictable. Which way is this going to go? I think for allies, they like predictability and like to know that the United States is going to be there for them. But then when it comes to adversaries, I do think there's an advantage to the unpredictability. But I do think there's an advantage when it comes to adversaries, because they don't know what they can get away with. They don't know, would Trump allow them to invade a neighbor, or would he retaliate in some big way? We remember the threats of fire and fury that Trump made against Kim Jong-un that I think had everybody nervous. And so it is notable that Putin invaded neighboring countries under Bush, W. Bush. He invaded Georgia under Obama, invaded Ukraine for the first time, and under Biden invaded further invasion of Ukraine, but didn't invade his neighbors under Trump. And I think in part that is because he didn't know how Trump would respond. So I think there is a deterrence benefit, even if there may be a cost when it comes to allies and domestic public opinion.
Mm. Here's a question from Milo Smith, another one of our subscribers. And he asks, considering Trump was very pro-Israel during his first term, what would be his policy in his second term?
Yes, and I think Middle East policy is an area that has become more partisan over the past several administrations, dating back to at least the Iran nuclear deal, if not earlier. And I think the conservative approach is to work with traditional American partners in the region, like Israel and the Gulf states, Jordan and others, and to organize the region against Iran and the threats that Iran poses. With the, I think then with Biden and the Democrats, there was a sense of, no, we can work with Iran. Let's try to get back into the Iran nuclear deal. Maybe our traditional partners are part of the problem. Biden referred to Saudi Arabia as a pariah state. Relations between the United States and Israel are probably lower today than they've been at any point in recent memory. And so I do think a Trump administration would go back to something similar to what they did in the first term of strengthening the partnership with Israel and traditional partners in the region, trying to build upon the Abraham Accords, maybe try to get normalization with Saudi Arabia and others, and a much tougher approach on Iran, back to more of a maximum pressure approach, sanctions, military threats to contain the threats that Iran poses.
Mm. So let's talk about who has Trump's ear. There's a long list of people, Matt, who will never work for Trump again. John Bolton, for example, who would work for him? So were Trump to get reelected, who would his key foreign policy advisors be?
Well, this is a favorite parlor game in Washington right now. And so there's been a lot of speculation. Trump himself hasn't said anything publicly, so we don't know. But some of the possibilities, Mike Pompeo served as Secretary of State, CIA director in the first term. He was asked if he'd be willing to serve again, and he said he'd be honored to serve. And so he's a possibility. Rick Grenell, who was ambassador to Germany in the first term, is rumored to be also on the short list for a Trump 2 administration. Others as well, a number of members of Congress or the Senate who may be interested. Haggerty, senator, is a former ambassador to Japan, is mentioned as a possible Secretary of State. Tom Cotton, mentioned as a former Secretary of Defense. So I do think that there are a lot of good qualified people who would want to serve and who Trump, who are in Trump's good graces.
And is it your sense that all of these people you've named, that their general views of what a Trump 2.0 foreign policy should look like, does that broadly align with your vision for this sort of Reagan-Trump fusionism that you and your co-author are sort of advancing as a theory?
I think so. And so, as you mentioned, we did have a nice foreword from Mike Pompeo on the front of our book. We had a nice endorsement from Robert O'Brien in the back of the book. So two of the people I just mentioned. Now, I do think there are some differences of opinion within the party. So I do think you have some like J.D. Vance, Josh Hawley, and others who are, I think, a little bit more isolationist. But I don't think that represents the or Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz in the House. And so I think there is that view within the party, and there has always been that view within the party. We've had Rand Paul as a prominent senator from Kentucky with similar views for many years. So I think there is that strain of thinking within the party. But I don't think that's where Trump is, and I don't think that represents the mainstream of the party.
In many ways, it strikes me that you've got sort of your vision, which is trying to define and lay claim to what a new Trumpism could be, and even what the old Trumpism was. But some of the people you mentioned, were you to ask them, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, a J.D. Vance, they might have a very different understanding of what Trumpism was and what it could be, no?
I think that's right. And I think they're wrong. And that's part of the reason I wanted to write the book. And I think you do have some people kind of trying to redefine Trumpism as isolationism and saying, this is what Trump stands for. This is where the party is today. This is where we should be going. And I just think that's incorrect. If you look at the way Trump actually governed in his first term, if you look at what he said about his policies for a second term, I don't think they're isolationist. People might disagree with them, but I think it still assumes an engaged America in the world. And if you look at public opinion, and I will have to go back and look at this Chicago poll that you mentioned, but I don't think that the average Republican voter wants the United States to come home. I think they still understand that having the United States engaged in the world is good for their interest. So yes, I think there is a minority view that's isolationist, but I don't think that's where the mainstream of the party is.
You know, Matt, a lot of times when I see you, it tends to be in foreign capitals at big conferences. I last saw you in New Delhi, in Singapore at the Shangri-La Dialogue. You were also in Munich this year at the Security Conference. I know you speak to a lot of national security policymakers around the world. There is a growing sense among that community globally that they might need to prepare for a Trump 2.0 White House. And for many people, especially in Europe, for example, there's a lot of talk of Trump-proofing foreign policy. A lot of what you're saying is that you don't need to Trump-proof because what you're hearing isn't necessarily what Trump will do. Have you had much luck in sort of explaining that to your interlocutors when you travel around the world?
Yeah, good questions. And at the Atlantic Council, we have allied officials coming through almost daily. And this is the first question I always get is the same questions we've just been discussing. What would a Trump 2 administration look like? Who would the key advisors be? And, you know, what these officials tell me might be something different than what they tell you, because you're right that some are worried. But some of them say, you know what, we're an important ally. We know that the United States understands why they need to work with us. We were able to deal with Trump in the first term. We'll be able to deal with him in a second term. And I think in some parts of the world, like in the Middle East, there's maybe a sense that the U.S. alliance relationship would improve in a Trump administration over where it is now with the Biden administration. But you are also right that there is worry, and I think in European capitals especially. But I think my message would be, yes, that maybe they're worrying too much. And I think that you have some people, including people who don't want Trump to win the next election, who have an incentive to portray a Trump 2 and Trump is more extreme than I think they are. And so I think there are people out there fanning the flames, trying to get people to worry. And my advice to European officials is I say, do spend your 2% on defense if you're a NATO member. One, it's the right thing to do. Two, if Trump's elected, you can say, we're not free riders, we're pulling our weight. And then third, and I think this is least likely, but if the United States were to suddenly turn isolationist, then they are in a better position to defend themselves. So I think that I have seen some extreme proposals, like maybe we need to think about France and Germany providing a nuclear umbrella to the rest of Europe to make up for the U.S. umbrella. And I think measures like that will not be necessary. I think that NATO will continue to exist at the end of a Trump 2 administration. The U.S. nuclear umbrella will probably be stronger after a Trump 2 administration than it is now. So my advice would be worry less.
Worry less is always good advice. Matt, you and I disagree on a lot, but I always learn so much from talking to you. So thank you for joining us.
Ravi, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for your probing questions and look forward to the next time.
And that was Matthew Kronig, the co-author of We Win, They Lose, Republican Foreign Policy and the New Cold War.
Remember, if you want to stay abreast of who we have coming up, just go to our website, foreignpolicy.com. You can register to watch all of these conversations live and on video. FP Live, the podcast, is produced by Rosie Julin. The executive producer of FP Live is Dana Shern. I'm Ravi Agrawal. I'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Annalise Riles, professor of law at Northwestern University. I'm also an anthropologist and the host of a new podcast, Everyday Ambassador, where we give you the small tools that make big change. The idea for this show has been a long time in the making. I actually remember the exact day I started thinking about it. It was March 11th, 2011. I was in Japan conducting research on the financial markets of Tokyo. All of a sudden, I heard a loud rumbling sound and the room started shaking. Everything came crashing off the shelves. I looked out the window and I could see the skyscrapers swaying so much that they looked like they would touch. And then the sirens started going off. A tsunami was on the way. These were the harbingers of one of Japan's worst ever disasters, the meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear power plant.
The Japanese government now says two reactors are in partial meltdown and four more are at risk.
The meltdown completely turned Japan on its head. I saw hundreds of stunned office workers covered in dust walking down empty train tracks to get from the city to their homes in the suburbs. Electricity was out, internet, cell phones. Supplies flew off the shelves of stores. Geiger counters became an in-demand item, which is never a good thing. Living through a crisis of this magnitude was an inflection point for me. To prevent the next Fukushima or any of the other crises we face today, we'll have to work much more effectively across silos of expertise and national boundaries. And we'll need to harness the wisdom of everyone, from local fishers to nuclear physicists, on how the world really works and what happens when things go awry. Using this approach, I've gone on to spur countless innovations in global policy. And that's what this podcast is all about. Everyday Ambassador peels back the curtains of high-stakes leadership and gives everyone backstage access to the most powerful methods of diplomacy. In each episode, we'll break things down into deceptively simple moves that everyone can make to help build a more peaceful and sustainable world. Like giving a gift.
You want to make it tasteful. You want to make it thoughtful. You thought about the other individual. You thought about what their likes and dislikes are.
Or creating a fiction.
Taking on a fictional scenario and a role outside of the one that you occupy in your day-to-day life allows you to think through what you would like to have done differently.
Or just taking the time to have fun.
Trying to see this as more so building long-term relationships that are going to be helpful down the line when negotiations are a bit harder, as all negotiations are.
Each week, you'll hear surprising stories which reveal the moves you can make to change the status quo, to find ways to connect and move things forward. So join me and become an Everyday Ambassador, coming to you this spring on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen.